I'm going to bring the committee to order. Representative Burns, I know you've looked at all the minutes and found them to be appropriate, so would you move them?
I will move them, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, members. All in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That. I think we got most of our business done that we need to get done, and I am pretty excited today. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I want to welcome you to the Bioscience and Emergency Technologies Committee. We had a little snafu, so I won't read all of my prepared minutes here, and I want to give you as much time as possible. But this is a wonderful tool that you're bringing from Sandia Labs, and hopefully we can find the money in the budget to bring this modeling to our state. I know how important it can be for us as we try to make decent policy and good policy for our children and grandchildren. I'm not going to take any more time. I know this is Representative Winkler's bill, and hopefully he'll have a few words at the end. So please proceed if you could. And, oh, one more thing. I want to welcome the speaker to our committee here today, and I really appreciate her coming. And any other legislators that you see wander in here, I want you to make sure that you get them down to the table, folks.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and we'll just be taking names of those committee members who aren't here and do with their bills what must happen.
Okay. Yeah, I've already got started on that as my reputation precedes me. So, Ms. Wallstrom, please introduce your guests and our guests. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Madam Speaker. Representative Mahoney, I'm extremely thrilled to be able to be the one to represent here, to present the Sandia folks to you, and I'll do that in a second. We have some other people here today I'd like to introduce very quickly. I'd like to ask Alex Cirillo and Jim Benson to hold up their hands and stand up, one or two. Alex and Jim are the two chairs, the chair and the co-chair of our Destination 2025 process. I'd also like to ask everybody that's here that's involved with the bioscience initiatives we have in place in terms of our Destination 2025, the Board of Directors, the Governance Council, the Action Committee, all the different groups. If you just hold up your hands and give a sense of the amount. And this is a tiny, just to let you know, this is a tiny fraction of the people who are currently involved in it, and it's really doing well. Okay, what we're trying to do quickly is, what I'm going to do in the next 2 minutes is give you context. Because the model, as you're about to hear, is the tool that we're employing to accomplish what we think is even a higher level goal, which is to create a Destination 2025 strategy. That Destination 2025 strategy is charged at giving us a roadmap for the future in the area of biosciences. And those biosciences, to refresh your memory, range from renewable energy through medical devices, through biotechnology, et cetera. And it's that higher level strategy. It's the action items that will come out of the process of identifying our strengths, our weaknesses, the opportunities, the risks, and the constraints that we will be able to help to provide clarity on funding, clarity on policy, clarity on academic needs, research needs, etc. But that is a very difficult task to do, because there's so many different interconnecting subunits of the strategy that need to be considered, ranging from the limit. So, in the sake of brevity, I just say this: the tool that you're about to see is a tool. It's one of many that we will use to build this strategy. It happens to be a tool that is specifically designed to try to take very complex problems, break them down into components that you can deal with, so that you can manage your way through a difficult process. We are very, very fortunate, and I want to call out Madam Speaker, as someone who has experience with this and recognizes the value and has been very supportive, and thank you very much for helping us to get to this point. I've used this myself in my other life prior to becoming involved with the BioBusiness Alliance for about the last 18 years. I can vouch for its ability to take difficult situations and allow you to come quickly and effectively to a conclusion or a happy place. The presentation that we're going to have today by Sandhya is going to be broken down into two parts. And the reason for that is there's two things we're really looking for from Sandhya and its people. One is the application of this tool. And the two gentlemen who will be presenting that are Len Malchinsky. Is that close enough, Len? I always mispronounce Len's last name. And Howard Passel. And Howard and Len are both... Howard is an ecologist. Len is a software engineer and is focused on economy. But both of them have been working in the area of systems dynamic modeling for many years and are experts in that, in application. They'll show us what they've done in other areas and then refer that back and help to put context around what they're going to help us do here in Minnesota. The second part of the presentation will be Grant Heppelfinger. Grant is the Senior Manager for Molecular and Computational Biosciences and also the Lead Manager for Sandia's work in the area of renewable fuels. So the second thing we want from Sandia is access to knowledge, access to their 8,000, I believe close to 9,000 people that are working in the area of science and technology, so we can learn from that where possible and extract and apply that to our needs here in the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'm going to stop and turn it over to Len. Thank you.
I'd like to say thanks to Dale and members of the committee. You should have a copy of this small 8-page brochure. We were trying to find a very simple introductory statement about what system dynamics is, and this actually comes from the British Health Service, so maybe there's some applicability here, but my goal in the next just few minutes is to talk about what system dynamics is, what it can be used for. And, of course, you can read this at your leisure. This is the section I'd like to focus on. Essentially, system dynamics says that the world is composed of things that accumulate and things that flow. And the metaphor that most people use is a bathtub. You can imagine that a bathtub collects water, and it has a faucet or a valve that flows water into the tub, and some other sort of valve that takes water out of the tub. So the system dynamics methodology just says we should be able to break the world down into a sequence of flow rates and tubs, so to speak. So in our case, we talked about biofuels quickly. For example, the number of acres you have in corn cultivation for ethanol, that would be a tub. That would be a stock of acreage. That stock of acreage changes how? Well, farmers put fields into production. So that's a flow rate coming in. How does that acreage diminish? Well, it can diminish through people taking it out of production, switching to another crop. Maybe the soil is degraded to the point where it can no longer produce. But hopefully that gives you some idea of how system dynamics, of what system dynamics is composed. This particular picture, though, tells about how do you take a group of stakeholders, like the folks here in Minnesota, and get them to work together to build such a model, which then becomes computerized and is useful for policy making. And so typically what we do is we look at things that have occurred over time in the past, and we look at where you'd like to be in the future. We also look at where you're afraid you might be in the future. After that step is completed, we try to make some mental models of what are the stocks and flows that have brought us to this point. What kinds of things have probably caused this behavior in the past, and what kinds of things may lead to our desired behavior and to our feared behavior. And then our final step is to actually operationalize all of our thinking into a computer model that can be tested and experimented with and improved, et cetera, et cetera. And in a few minutes, Howard will show you an example of how we've done that in the state of New Mexico. But at its basic level, it's actually a very quite simple methodology. The process of accomplishing it is very, very important, and having interested parties and people willing to work hard and work together is also very important. And I'm, in the interest of time, I'm going to pass it over to Howard so you can see a real-world example of how we've done this.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, members of the committee, friends, it's a great pleasure to be here. Partly because of this very progressive project that the state of Minnesota is undertaking, and I'll show you how the state of New Mexico has used these similar kinds of approaches, but partly because I've had allergies in New Mexico, and I came to Minnesota and they've been cured. So in addition to developing your biosciences capability, if you ever want to advertise Minnesota as for its curative properties, then Cynthia will offer testimonials to that too. Following Len's description of system dynamics as a bathtub valve metaphor, let me show you an actual model on the screens here. I'm not sure if you can actually read some of the titles on these objects, but this is a very simple piece of a much larger, much more complex model. And this is the bathtub that represents surface water in the Middle Rio Grande Basin, which is right around Albuquerque, New Mexico. So this is all the surface water in the Middle Rio Grande Basin. Here are the inflows to that bathtub, to that stock of surface water. And the inflows are made up of various variables. And you can see that this is the way the model actually goes together. If I open this object, then there's an equation inside that object. And these objects can be populated with equations or data or functions or whatever you need to put in them. So here's the bathtub that represents surface water in the basin. These are the inflows to that bathtub, and these are the outflows to that bathtub, and these are all the different uses of surface water and all the other ways in which surface water is lost from the basin. So this is just an example to make a smooth transition from Len's description of system dynamics into the model that I'm going to show you. This is a piece of a much bigger model, and this is not a very user-friendly image. This is not an image we'd want to take out into the public and show to them as we try to work on how to balance water needs in the state of New Mexico. But here is an image that is more user-friendly. This is a model. This is the cover page to a model that we built, Sandia National Labs, in collaboration with a stakeholder team in the state of New Mexico. This stakeholder team was tasked by the state of New Mexico to come up with a water management plan for the Middle Rio Grande Basin. The stakeholder team included a very diverse set of stakeholders from many different sectors and disciplines. It included agriculturalists, environmentalists, economists, academicians, managers, water managers, real estate developers. All of these people came together into this very contentious environment to solve a very, very contentious problem in the state of New Mexico. That is, where are we going to get the water to proceed with the development that New Mexicans wish to have? So this group came together, and as they were trying to develop this water management plan, realized that this was an extremely complex problem, an extremely contentious problem, and they didn't have the means to thoroughly evaluate all the different options and the consequences of all the options. So we became involved in this stakeholder process and brought this modeling approach to try to integrate the knowledge that was spread out across all of these disparate stakeholders into a modeling tool that would allow us to integrate the knowledge, integrate the data, and create a tool that would allow us to see the consequences of different kinds of strategy options. So what you're seeing here is the end result of that project. Since then, this process has been implemented in various places around the world, including the state of New Mexico, which has adopted it for managing water resources in a couple of other very important water basins in New Mexico, one in the Membris Basin and one in the Gila Basin. So let me show you how the model works so that you have a better sense of what we're talking about. This is a model that has been developed, and it appears on the World Wide Web, so you could actually access this model if you wanted to. And one of the reasons we built it was to assist the stakeholders in coming up with a management plan, but it was also to educate the people of New Mexico in the way water systems work. So that's why you see all of this text. We have very little time, so I'm going to give you a very quick view of how this model works and how it can contribute. This is one of the many output pages in the model. There are many, many graphs that show you the results of the strategy options that you choose in the model. And this is just one page of them, and there's four here, so this gives you a very high-level view of the results of whatever strategy options you might choose. One that's very important here is the cumulative Rio Grande compact balance. That describes New Mexico's ability to meet its legal obligations downstream. A certain amount of water flows into the basin. Based on that amount of water, a certain amount of water must flow out of the basin to downstream users. If we fail to meet that obligation, then we're legally liable, and there'll be a lot of trouble for the region if it can't meet that legal obligation. And so what you see here is, starting in 1960, when the model begins its run, we are in a deficit situation with regards to our compact balance obligations. Coming out of the 60s and into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we achieve a balance, which is where we want to be, right around the zero line. Can you all see these numbers, or is it all too small? This is zero on this graph, and we want to be hovering right around zero. But what the model shows as it projects forward into the future is that we're going to, according to the assumptions in our model and according to the way we built the model based upon all that stakeholder input, the model predicts or projects that we will fall into a deficit situation with regards to our water, with regards to our obligations, our legal obligations. That's completely untenable. The Supreme Court already ruled against New Mexico in a similar situation, showing that we must make we must meet our commitments to these downstream obligations. So this is completely untenable. It has to be fixed, and the state of New Mexico has to figure out how is it going to fix it. And there are dozens of alternatives, and a very, very large number of combinations of alternatives that could be implemented. And so the people in the state of New Mexico have to be able to weigh all the different strategy options and combinations of strategy options. And this is far too complex for my feeble mind to tackle without the assistance of some kind of a tool like this for integrating across all those different options. So we will address this problem in the next couple of minutes. We will try to solve this problem. There are, as I said, dozens of different strategy options available to us in all of these categories: residential, non-residential use of water. The forest that lines the river is called the bosque. That's Spanish word for forest. It's one of the largest remaining riparian forests in the Southwest, so for environmentalists, it's very important that we maintain that forest. And that, of course, takes a lot of water out of the ground, out of the river, and evaporates it up into the sky. Agriculture is a big user of water. Again, I'm sorry you can't read these, but these are all categories of changes that can be made. So, for example, one of the sets of changes to water management in the basin can be made in agriculture. Lots of different changes can be made that will save water or use more water. One way to save water is to line the conveyances that move water to the farms. One is to change the way water is used on the farms. And so all of these slider bars allow you to make modifications to the way water is currently used in the basin. And I'll dwell on this for just a minute. This is a distribution of crop types in the basin. So what you see here, this says alfalfa, corn, sorghum, wheat, oats, fruit, and so on. What we see in this bar graph is that alfalfa here and pasture hay here make up the lion's share of the crops that are cultivated in the Middle Rio Grande Basin, well over 90%. What we can do here is we can simulate what would happen if we changed the crop type distribution in the basin. So what we can do is we can simulate a reduction of the amount of alfalfa grown in the basin, and we can simulate a reduction in the amount of pasture hay grown in the basin. So as I move these bars, you see the blue bars down below change? That's showing you that on average, well, total crop area has been reduced considerably, and on average, total crop consumption has changed. So we've essentially changed the mix of crops grown in the Middle Rio Grande Basin. Now, in this case, we are not addressing the policy options or the policy incentives associated with making that change. In other words, there would have to be legislative measures taken to change the crop mix. There would have to be fiscal incentives created or subsidies created, something to get farmers to change their cropping patterns. We don't deal with that in this model, but that could be dealt with in this model. Now, some would argue that reducing the cultivated area in New Mexico or in the Middle Rio Grande Basin is not a good idea because we might want that area for growing crops in the future. So we can also simulate putting those crops back, but putting them back in something that uses less water. So that's that last category, miscellaneous vegetables. So you see now we're back to 50,000 acres in our total crop area, but we're using, on average, a lot less water. Now, we're going to go back to this general results page. And we're going to look at what's the result of that change projected over time using historical data on precipitation and climate variables, because we don't know what the weather will be, but we can make a projection about future weather based on historic weather, and we can vary those projections. So, I'm going to run the model now, and it's going to run from 1960 to 2050. And it's going to draw on historic data and project it forward. The model runs from 1960 to 2004 using historic data. It's calibrated to historic data. Starting in 2005, it projects historic data. It mixes it up and projects it out into the future to 2050. And when I run the model, you'll see it run very quickly. It runs in 6 or 7 seconds. And the model is aggregated on an annual time step. That means it takes all of the calculations over the course of a year and adds them all together and projects them forward. So here we go. I'll run the model. Okay, so what do we see? We see a big change to the region's capability to meet its legal obligation downstream. Not enough, because we're not back up to zero, but a big change. And we don't see any change in this term over here, the cumulative groundwater depletion term. This is the bathtub in the basin. This is the underground aquifer. What we see here is starting in 1960, the people of New Mexico have been sticking straws into the aquifer, drawing water out of that basin, and water has been leaking in much more slowly than we have been taking it out. So the level of that water has gone down. So we see that we have not been able to affect that very much at all by the measures we took here. So we would have to go back and do something else to solve this problem. Let me take one more minute and show you one more example. I'm going to reset the model so that we go back to the permanent variables. We go back to the default run of the model. And I'll show you how we could affect this term right here. In residential use, there are a lot of people who have argued that by using low-flow appliances, we can solve, if people would use less water in the basin in their homes, then we could solve the problem in the Middle Rio Grande Basin. So we have the capability in the model to simulate the conversion of existing homes to low-flow appliances. So I'm going to slide this slider bar up to 60%. So this simulates changing 60% of existing homes to low-flow appliances. And I'll click on this little button here, which simulates building all new construction in the basin with low-flow appliances. Do the same thing for non-residential uses. We'll simulate 60% of non-residential uses, like commercial properties and universities and schools, being converted to low-flow appliances, and all future commercial properties being converted. So now, let's go see what those changes will result in the model. We're looking at this curve now. I'll run the model. And we see a slight improvement in our groundwater. That is, we're taking less water out of the ground. We're we're taking less water out of the ground, so we see an improvement to the groundwater term, but it actually impairs our ability to meet the Rio Grande compact bounds. This is a very interesting finding to everybody in the basin, because they don't expect that if we use less water, we will actually impair our legal obligations downstream. And the reason is, if we take less water out of the ground, use less water in our homes, we flush less water down the toilets, less goes through the sewage treatment plant, and less goes back into the river. So this is a connection in the basin that most people don't understand, but when they see the model play out, then they're forced to confront this reality. I'll stop at this point, partly because my voice is failing and partly because I don't want to go on too long. And I'll turn this over to Grant and let Grant tell you some things about Sandia National Laboratories and the laboratory system in general. Thank you very much for your attention.
My name is Grant Heppelfinger. I'm the senior manager at Sandia Labs. I've worked there for about 18 years. I actually grew up just south of here in Sioux City, Iowa. Worked my way through Iowa State to pass on corn, so I'm very familiar with corn, or at least I have been. Went from Iowa State to Cornell for a PhD, and went from there to Sandia in the late 80s. I got into science and engineering because of the 73 oil crisis. That's what piqued my interest. And so for me, the return of $70 a barrel of petroleum has been a resurgence of long-standing interests in science and engineering and the applicability to the nation's problems. It's also the reason that I'm at Sandia Labs, which is a U.S. Department of Energy National Security Laboratory, National Laboratory, which has a mission derived from its DOE role for national security and for energy security. So it's a great place to work. It's part of a laboratory system of some 11 or 12 labs. There are three very large labs, which are called multi-program labs. Those three are Sandia, Lawrence Livermore, and Los Alamos. And Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore are primarily physics labs or science labs, whereas Sandia is an engineering lab. We do what we call science-based engineering primarily. Those are some of the distinguishing characteristics of Sandia. The other labs in the lab system are smaller and tend to be more focused and less multi-program. A really good example relevant to this discussion is the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, which is about 1,000 folks working on renewable energies across the full spectrum. and they do a lot of good work in that area, and we collaborate a lot with them as well. Other things that I'm involved in at Sandia, just to frame the discussion, we have a cooperative research and development agreement with Monsanto Company. These are called CRADAs. It's a vehicle for the laboratories to work with industry, where industry provides us funding and we pursue a collaborative topic together. That particular one is on providing Sandia technology for U.S. agriculture applications. What we're doing at the moment is applying our imaging capabilities for plant tissue. And then I'm also the laboratory's institutional lead for the Joint Bioenergy Institute, which is our response to the U.S. DOE Office of Science call for Centers of Excellence in Bioenergy. This was a call that came out about August 2nd and was due February 1st. Our team is led by Lawrence Berkeley Lab, another DOE lab, and includes Sandia and Lawrence Livermore, Stanford, UC Davis, and UC Berkeley. And the PI is Jay Kiesling. That's a $125 million proposal for systems biology issues relevant to cellulosic ethanol. So that kind of frames a little bit about what we're doing. Let's see. In terms of Sandia's culture and the way we do work, as well as the kinds of differentiating capabilities that you find at Sandia, as I mentioned, we're an engineering lab, so we do a lot of work with industry. We do a lot of CRADAs. A good example, the largest CRADA that we ever did was called the Extreme Ultraviolet Lithography Program, and this was with a consortium. It was a 501c3 that was built by the electronics toolmaker industry to reduce the length scale for electronics. And this was about a $300 million activity that took place over 5 or 10 years. The second largest CRADA that the lab did was one that I engineered myself. It was with Celera Genomics. You'll probably recall that Celera was the company, that the private company that was sequencing the human genome. This was Craig Venter's company. And Craig was interested in getting access to Sandia's high-performance computing expertise. Sandia is a pioneer in massively parallel supercomputing, so the idea of using many, many, many processors to carry out large simulations. I like to ask people, how many of you have run a job on a massively parallel supercomputer? and the answer is all of you if you've done a search on Google. Because when you do a search on Google, it parses the whole internet space and each processor takes a piece of it. And what Sandia excels at is building large computers where you can, instead of dividing the problem in what's called an embarrassingly parallel fashion, you take one particular code and you run it on all processors, so the processors have to talk to each other. So we own the intellectual property for our latest computer, both the a lot of the chip design, the communications, as well as the operating system. And that technology has been leased to licensed to Cray Research, the former Minnesota company, now Seattle-based company, which is marketing, and that's the Red Storm computer. It's another example of Sandia's engineering expertise being applied. The clean room, which is used in the semiconductor industry, was invented at Sandia. The Rolamite, which is a little actuator found in every airbag in every car, was invented at Sandia. A number of the differentiating capabilities at the laboratory span the physical and chemical and engineering sciences. We have a large materials program. We have one of the DOE Centers for Nanotechnology. That's a joint activity with Los Alamos National Labs. We do a lot of work in renewable energy. We have a solar thermal facility which uses computer-controlled mirrors to track the sun and focus the energy on a solar power tower where an exotic salt is used to capture the energy. We do work in wind energy, photovoltaics. We do a lot of work with microsystems and microfluidics. If you're familiar with Semitech, when the government put Semitech together, Sandia was considered as a possible home for Semitech. Ended up being put in Austin, Texas instead. We've just finished a $500 million capital investment in microsystems. And we also are home to the DOE's combustion research facility. My boss is the director for biological and energy sciences, so there are four pieces in his organization. There are two biology pieces, one of which I manage, and two pieces focused on combustion. So within that one organization is a Sandia's fundamental science capability relevant to biofuels in general. The budget for the lab is about $2.3 billion. It's some 8,700 employees at two sites. About six-sevenths are in Albuquerque, where I live, and another seventh or so is in Livermore, California, across the street from Lawrence Livermore National Lab. One of the things that I'll close with, which distinguishes Sandia as well, is that Congress has recognized the work that's carried out at the national laboratories relevant to preserving and extending America's science and technology prowess, and they have authorized us to spend a measure of our budget on what's called laboratory-directed research and development, or LDRD. And so we have funding that's set aside within our budget to pursue that, and at a large lab like Sandia, that's about $120 or $130 million. And that allows us to make strategic investments at various scales to carry out fundamental science in preparation for what we believe are coming issues. And we're investing heavily in biofuels, and we're also able to make investments of a very large scale. We do what are called Grand Challenge Laboratory LDRDs, which can be as much as $15 million investments over 3 years. So that gives you sort of a sketch of Sandia. As I said, most of our money comes from the Department of Energy. We also have a lot of work for the national security three-letter agencies. We've got a large satellite program, for example, and we do a lot of work with industry. And we collaborate a lot with universities as well. We send, last time I checked, some $80 million to universities through collaborations. Okay?
Okay, Mr. Chair, we did that in a kind of warp state because we were a little short on time. But we want to leave at least 5-10 minutes, which I think is about the time frame we have left, for questions and answers. I would open it up by simply saying that I want to, again, express on behalf of everybody who's involved in the BioBusiness Alliance and what we're trying to accomplish here at the state level, our appreciation to Sandy and the folks that are here, as well as the folks that they represent back home, which is a lot of them. And if you ever have an opportunity to go down and visit, it's worth the trip. It's an amazing place to go into. We're very happy and feel proud to be able to have a partner such as Sandy to work with on this program. And at this point in time, I'd like to just say we will take any questions you have. And
I'm going to. Does the speaker have any particular questions?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if I have questions as much as a couple comments. I experienced doing system dynamics in my coursework for my MPA at the Kennedy School. I actually took a course in system dynamics modeling at MIT at the Sloan School, and I'm not quite sure how I got through it, but I did. I enjoyed it a great deal, and it was the course is modeling its business system dynamics. About a quarter of it, though, was public policy. And I just really appreciate that Dale and his crew are here today and the folks from Sandia, because I think that one of the things I learned in that process is we don't have any way of teaching system dynamics here in Minnesota. There are about 14 to 15 locations around the country where systems is actually taught in universities, and they actually train people of how to create a model like that, and honestly, believe it or not, I was able to create models like that by the end of a semester, the sort of back shelf model that you saw where you're writing equations and making the model run. I know, Representative Mahoney, it's hard to believe. I have a secret math brain that I bring out every now and then. I really would encourage the committee, and I know that, you know, this is ultimately a funding issue in terms of Representative Rukavina's committee, but to really try to take the leap here and both learn from the modeling that's going to be done here on renewables and eventually medical devices in the state to build on our strengths, but also to maybe put in the works some ability for us to actually teach system dynamics modeling here in Minnesota. And the actually the confluence of both business system dynamics and public policy system dynamics, because I think it has a lot of applications. I would love it someday if we actually had someone who could do modeling in-house research. I think this would be a great advantage to us as we analyze policy decisions, because if you use the data available to you, it takes away, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it works on the assumptions you make moving forward with a model to make a policy decision. And so often we're guessing about those things in the process that, you know, we have and have used for now 150 years. But I think it has some real potential for our state, and I just really appreciate you allowing me to sit in on the committee, and I hope that each of you will take some, I took down the model here, the Rio Grande model. I'm going to go play with it at some point, sometime late at night when I need to escape. But I think it's really important for us to think about how we can do public policy decision making in a better way. And I just appreciate the BioBusiness Alliance leadership on this, in particular in these important economic areas where we have the potential to really leap ahead, but different choices will lead to different outcomes for the state. And so I think it's really critical for us to have our eyes wide open as to what those things are. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, I just really appreciate you doing this today, and I hope we can get them around to some more members in the near future, the Energy Committee. I know that the other thing I should mention, I think the folks on health maybe saw a brief presentation of some work that's being done in the state on diabetes modeling, in terms of what some of the what the system looks like there. So I think that's another exciting thing that's going on with our Department of Health right now and system dynamics modeling.
Well, I'm gonna take the prerogative of the chair to ask the first question, and I appreciate the speaker and the representatives that are not on the committee that joined us today. because this is a pretty important project for the state, I think. But I'm going to ask, can you, in a brief kind of answer, tell how this could help with the biofuels or with wind energy or nanotechnology, and how we could, relatively briefly, because I think it would be a 4-hour long discussion if we really got into it, but just to give us a small kind of inkling on it.
Okay. What, in fact, when we leave here at 11 o'clock, we are going to a meeting with, a joint meeting with AURI, the Agriculture Utilization Research Institute, who is, by the way, a fantastic partner for us to work with on bringing together the agricultural community, the growers, the producers, the academics, the whole group. I think there's a couple of folks, like Dr. Valvaldi, I believe, is here, who's also part of that, and several others. But anyway, what we need to frame that question precisely, and as an example, in talking with Beth Padoon, who's in the corner representing the governor's office, one of the potential outcomes or one of the potential things we might focus on might be how do we attain 25 by 25, because by providing different options and different scenarios for achieving that, the law that was recently signed into, we might be able to help give direction on policy decisions or the kinds of research investments that we need to make or kinds of academic investments that need to be made. So in that particular scenario, should this team choose for that to be the question, that one of the questions that we work on, it would be targeted specifically at this is the outcome we want. How can we possibly get there by blending wind, fuel, ethanol, biodiesel. There's a mixture, and each one of those have limits, and each one of those have constraints that are placed around it. And by eliminating, identifying first, quantifying, and then blending those limits and those constraints, we believe we can come to a successful scenario that would allow us to achieve 25 by 25. But again, I want to repeat, the team that AURI is leading will be the team that will decide exactly how to specify that question and set the direction, but that would be an example. Did that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
Close. I've always got another question. You should be in this committee. Mm-hmm. We get questions on a regular basis. Any other questions from the committee? Approximately how long does there's no others. I've got a bunch of them. So let's say that this all comes to fruition and we move forward with this funding. Could we expect to see some information that we could use for policy decisions, what, a month out, January, a year from now?
Our target right now for delivering the first draft model of renewable is late summer. And about 3 months after that, 3 to 4 months after that is our targeted time zone right now for the first blending of devices and biotech.
And I'm going to ask the people from Sandia, how long did it take you to put together the Rio Grande model? You might want to identify yourself just for the mic.
I'm Howard Purcell from Sandia National Labs. The model that you saw was the result of 3 years of work. That included about a year and a half of meetings every 2 weeks with the stakeholder group. So the model that you saw is an intensive labor effort. But a lot of the labor went into the interface that you saw with all the text and all the descriptions and but also a lot of the work involved is in data collection, identifying the right data, identifying the structure, understanding how the systems work, pulling all the experts together, getting consensus among all the experts to build the model.
So the 3 years, a year of it or 2.5 years of it was kind of the technical, putting that all together, and the other part was kind of getting the information?
About a year and a half was the actual model construction. Okay. And then a lot of the time was the involved the stakeholders using the model to analyze all of their different strategy options and answer all the questions that they had to ask about the way the systems work.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, I guess, is maybe for Mr. Wallstrom. By way of valedictory for our committee, we've seen that Minnesota has a number of strengths in the bioscience economy, and we have a number of shortcomings that we need to address. Some of the strengths are we're very strong in the medical device area, we're not so strong in pharmaceuticals, and the convergence of those two areas is something that we need to address. We know that we are short on angel and venture capital investment in technology in Minnesota, and that we need to improve our commercialization and spinoffs. And what that, and then in biofuels, we are have a strong combination in Minnesota of a strong agriculture sector and a strong high-tech sector, which may be unique among some states, California being a major competitor in that regard. But much of what we do is based on policy decisions at state government, but probably a greater share is due to private sector decisions, and I think of investments and spin-offs and commercialization, some of those issues. Mm-hmm. Is the model that you're putting together going to help drive some decision-making or investment decisions in the private sector as well? How do we roll that out to them as opposed to just making that something that state government attempts to do, which may be at cross purposes if a company has a business plan that takes them in a different direction? Mm-hmm. How do we get the buy-in on the private side?
Excellent question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ross.
Our intention is to make the model available to anybody in the state who wants it. And we will sit down and present to a company, to a membership organization such as Life Science Alley, to any group in industry that represents industry, academia, or government. The issue we will have, of course, it's just an issue, but the one of the constraints we have with the private sector is of course, they're not going to want to share a lot of what they're working on because, and we don't want them to because there's a confidential nature to that, for obvious reasons. But if we, as a nonprofit, can represent the best thinking from the people who are in the audience here as well as the people who are in our community, of what we believe the markets will look like. And there are seven of them. What we believe those markets will look like in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and 20 years, and have the data put into a model representation that backs that up, we think we will get their attention, and we think that we'll be able to we don't ever want to be in a position trying to make decisions for anybody. It's present data and information in format that they can use to make their own. So, to be succinct, I guess, which Representative Mahoney has indicated many times I'm not good at, and he's right, is that we will make that information available through the various organizations that they're part of. And those we do have their ear, and we will make it, get it out there.
Representative Osfarth, you had a question?
Well, Chair members, I would like to offer this perhaps on, I'm from a rural area, and so of course we're very interested in the biofuels, and I'm actually from a county that likes to grow corn, and there's competition as we look to the cellulosic, and how's that going to happen, and so I foresee a model like this of just, and of course today, we're taking corn to a place and we're cooking it, and we're getting fuel. But there are certainly coal enzymes in place. There are possibly distribution systems where, you could break down the cellulose, material at the farm. And, you could have the model of dairy tanks, and being, bringing a slurry to a certain place. I mean, there's any number of ways to look at process or look at materials. And from a policy standpoint, as I listen to the, upcoming farm bill and things like that, I mean, so many times your policy sometimes isn't done in the most equitable way. I mean, it's done by who's on your committee. And if your committee, and I'm just trying to be honest about this, but, if your committee is staffed with people that grow sugar beets, they're not going to necessarily look at corn, or they're not going to necessarily look at cheap wood.
Right.
And so that's where I see the value of this, is you would actually have a model where, as Speaker Kelleher said earlier, you know, it's not even about Republican or Democrat to me. It's about good policy, and it's about what makes sense. So I don't know if you can even comment on that, but I mean, that's where I see the value of it, is just taking those components, if you will, of how we make decisions out and letting the computer do that generation to figure out, you know, what is the best material, what's the best process, you know, is there a new model, is there a new distribution way to actually make something. So I'll stop. That's probably why I'm not on this committee, is because I could get so excited about this stuff that, you know, I don't know.
You fit in. You fit in.
I foam at the mouth. I don't know.
I really fit in then with the chair. are there any other questions?
Is that addressed to anybody in particular?
No, I was the chair.
Oh.
Yeah, me. That would be me. And that's past history.
I would like to know, am I right, wrong? Are they able to do that as well?
Could you address that at all?
Yeah, that's exactly the kinds of things that we want to do in the model. You know, what you saw is not hardwired. That's not an environment that your system needs to fit into. We can build the model to suit whatever issues or questions or data or variables or crop types or issues that you all have in this area.
I'd like to comment on that, too. There's an old saying, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you're from, I won't use the energy industry because it's too sensitive, but if you're in a medical device industry and your solution is electronically based, every solution looks like has that electronic solution. I assume it's the same if your solution is wind. You're gonna believe wind is a solution. If your solution is ethanol, you believe ethanol is a solution. The reality is, in all cases that I've been involved in over the last couple of decades, it's always a blended solution. And the primary value of using a technique and a tool like this is to take those disparate opinions, get those people in the room together, and focus them on a model versus each other, so that you can put logic and reason to a final solution and diffuse the personalities that are involved. And that's the primary objective. One of the two primary objectives. One is data, formatted data, so you can follow it. The other is to diffuse and depersonalize the process so you can apply logic and come to an agreeable solution.
Representative Tingleston?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you, too, for opening this up to members outside your committee. So I learned some good things today. And I just want to kind of throw in the mix some of the things that the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources is doing. You know, that organization, that commission, is funded through the lottery proceeds. I'm the co-chair this year. And we kind of pride ourselves in being sort of the research and development branch for government in environmental policy making. And actually, we've seen some of the modeling through the LCCMR in a project where we did RFPs for a statewide conservation plan. And I know some of the people involved in that ongoing process here over the next year have been connecting through peer review with other states, and it's good to see some of this coming together. And certainly LCCMR will be looking more to this area as we look to funding projects for next year as well. So I just wanted to make sure you're aware of that.
I think Mr. Walsh just found out something. Speaker Carr.
Well, Mr. Carr, I think it's, and I think you're doing a nice job of doing this. I mean, we're focused in this committee on biosciences, the biofuels, renewables, medical devices, but anything can be modeled. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the amazing part of the thing. You know, we could model special ed. We could model early childhood. We could model those systems where we historically see many groups coming in to do battle over scarce resources, but if you can create a model around it, you can have a whole new look at where the drivers are, the positive and negative forces that are creating situations that either cost or save, and how we might then allocate scarce resources around that. And so I just think it has a lot of potential as a tool. It doesn't do everything for you. You have to have the human beings who can define the problem to do this. It's not going to give you a magic answer, because part of the thing about thinking about this is it's not linear thinking anymore. You're thinking in a system, and so there's different choices that can be made along the way. Those different choices are going to create different outcomes. And so I want to just keep, you know, it's really important that you stay focused in terms of the proposal before you and in Representative Winkler and Burns' bill, but it is also got some real advantages for us as decision makers when we only meet for 5 months of the year, in the longest period that we ever meet, to do some interim work using something like this and getting some folks trained so that we can maybe utilize it in some other areas. I'm now selling, and I shouldn't be, so I'll stop.
Actually, I'm going to follow up on that, because I know you have to leave like within minutes. So I'm going to say that one of the reasons that I was reasonably excited about this was the biosciences, as it was brought to me early in session. But as I kept thinking about this and talking with Representative Burns and Winkler and the speaker, I started to see that this is not something that just fits in this committee. This fits across the broad spectrum, whether it's crime prevention and our penitentiary systems, to our healthcare, to diabetes, to our universities and our workforce. This is something that the state, and I hope all the members encourage farther up the feeding chain of the legislative process the need to fund this, because this will hopefully help us regain some civility in politics as we take some of the rhetoric out and start actually looking at hard data. But with that, I know you have to go, so if there's any closing comments, please make them, and then we will let you go on to your next appointment. And I really appreciate you investing the time to come and talk with us today. So thank you very, very much.
I would just say thank you very much. It's been really great to work with this committee, so thank you for your attention and your support.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Members, with that, if there's any other thing, seeing none, we stand adjourned. Thank you.